Shrink Wrap Radio number 504, Using Mindfulness to Clear Emotional Clutter, with Donald Altman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Donald Altman, M.A., author of the new book, Clearing Emotional Clutter, and several other books about mindfulness. For more information about Donald Altman, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is Social Genomic Perspectives for the Neuropsychotherapist with Ernest Rossi, who I seem to recall is also a Jungian analyst. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today, and I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Now, here's the interview. Donald Altman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, hi, Dr. Dave. Pleasure to be here with you today.
Well, I'm pleased to have you on the show. You've written a number of books about meditation, and Clearing Emotional Clutter is your latest, and so we're going to be talking about that.
Oh, great. And thank you. I'm excited to share this information with people to help them deal with all the clutter that fills our heads up, that unlike physical clutter, which is very visible, you can see it, and probably a lot of people are familiar with the show Hoarders, mental or emotional clutter can have the same effect, only we're not always aware of how it can be filling our minds and keeping us from experiencing greater joy in this moment and connecting and responding more effectively right now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you write about emotional clutter, because I'm aware that there are a bunch of books, one in particular that's quite popular, but I'm not sure I remember the author's name, about decluttering one's life. Maybe you know the book I'm talking about. It's sort of a Zen approach to getting rid of the clutter in your house and so on.
Yeah, and I think there have been a couple really popular ones, and I'm just, the name is not coming to me, but I know what you're talking about.
Okay. Now, actually, I understand that you were a Buddhist monk for a time. Do I have that right?
That is correct. That is correct. That actually helped me really start to understand firsthand the nature of the mind and to learn how to distance from difficult or emotional thoughts. I had, if I could just share the story briefly.
I want you to feel free to share personal stories as well as any sort of, I know in your book you've got some kind of anecdotes about client situations. So stories and illustrations are very welcome.
Great. Well, this particular one, I mean, I had struggled with food and eating for a long period of my life, and I think most people can relate to maybe having eaten emotionally or know somebody who did that, right?
Yeah.
And so I, again, was having a hard time really moderating that, and at a kind of a difficult period of my life, I happened to meet this monk, and a friend of mine had said, "Oh, I think there's a monk I'd like you to meet," and I was just curious. And he was a Burmese monk from, of course, a traditional Burmese monk from Burma, who had, in the Theravada, the old school of Buddhism, had been in this country since the late 70s. It was a well-known teaching monk by the name of Uthilananda, and when I met him, I was just struck by that sense of availability and compassion, something I really hadn't experienced before. In fact, some of the Dalai Lama's monks have been put under MRIs to see how does the mind of somebody who's maybe done 10,000 hours of compassion training, how that changes the brain. And
yeah,
we learned that it dramatically changes the brain. I think that's what happened, was that when I met him, I really experienced this fundamental shift that in who he was, and it really struck me in a way that I wanted to know, how does somebody become like that? Because I had not really encountered anyone like that. And what I discovered was he really loved doing the loving kindness, the compassion meditation once I got to know him. But anyway, I was able to ordain with him as the head of the monastery. And he had written a book called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And I knew going in that I would have to face my issues with food, because the monks would get up at about 3:30 in the morning, actually, and there'd be chanting and different kinds of meditative practices. There'd be a short lunch from about 6:30 to 7 o'clock. Breakfast, rather, and then lunch was from 12 to noon. And you actually took a vow in that tradition not to eat after 12 noon. There was a reason for that. The real reason went back to the monks back in Buddha's day were spending so much time collecting food they didn't have any time to do anything else. So the Buddha thought they would be more effective if they just stopped eating after 12 noon.
Oh, that's fascinating. I've never heard that before.
Right, yeah, and so it also he felt it was a hardship on the community that they had to keep providing food for the monks throughout the day. So he thought it was good, good for both of them in that way. And of course that you could have a tea or a juice in the evening if you needed that, of course. So it wasn't so rigid. But anyway, I knew, given my history with food, that was going to be a challenge for me. And so I went in, I did this, it's a beautiful ordination ceremony, this ancient 2,500-year-old ceremony for becoming a monk. It really hasn't changed very much. And after that, and of course, when I took a vow not to eat after 12 noon, and they took me and two other new monks back into the monastery and brought us over to this room where there were three futons on the floor, and each one of us could just choose a futon. And I went and I sat down, and I think it just suddenly hit me. Here I was, they'd shaved my hair off, and I was in this saffron-colored robe, and the gravity of what I had done struck me, and I was like, oh my God, am I going to be able to get through this?
Yeah.
And
really?
I guess you could, yeah. And I could have, in that moment, used some food to comfort me, and that's what I had done in the past. And ironically, I looked to my left, and there was a shelving unit right next to the futon that I chose. Nobody told me to sit there. And on this shelving unit was one of those huge Cadbury's chocolate bars.
Oh, my goodness.
And they're, you know, the ones I'm talking about, I think they're, and I think your listeners will know, they're like supersized.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that.
And they're very good.
Yeah, they're very good. And my mind instantly wanted that chocolate bar to help comfort me in that moment with this. I was feeling very uncertain with the choice I had made, and I that would have at least distracted me. But I wasn't, you know, I had just taken a vow not to eat after 12 noon, and so my mind went into a war part of me that said, you know, that chocolate bar will make you feel better, it's just a chocolate bar, it's okay. And the other voice that said, no, I just took this vow and I have to hold true to that. So I had to sit there with those thoughts, because I couldn't go out and distract myself, or I couldn't go out and just avoid. I had to sit there and be present with it. And I will admit, I looked to see what the other monks were doing to see if maybe I could grab the chocolate bar and they wouldn't know.
Yeah.
But I felt I had taken this vow, and I just sat there, and it's difficult sometimes when we have to sit with those inner voices, inner parts of ourselves. But after about an hour or so, something really jolting to me happened, and I've since understood it in terms of brain science. I'd like to share that with your audience, is that suddenly, instead of grabbing onto those voices and identifying strongly with them, I was suddenly just watching observing in a very neutral way, watching these different parts of me. And it's as if I had, you know, like you're watching a scary movie and you're totally into it, but somebody turns on the lights and all of a sudden you realize, oh, I'm just watching a film here. There's nothing really scary here. And you stop identifying with the film and the characters. And that's what happened. It's as if I had stepped back. And I call it constructively distancing from our thoughts, constructively distancing from our mind. And what I didn't realize was that the part of the brain right behind my eyebrow ridge, and that is the most human part of the brain, actually. It's the prefrontal cortex is what it's sometimes called. In humans, we have much larger prefrontal cortexes that they can help us look inward, help us reflect on what's important to us, and they can actually help quiet down the more reactive, stress-triggering part of the brain. And in that moment, that's actually what had gotten activated, and so I was observing those thoughts. And I had somewhat of an epiphany in that moment that I realized that I could honor the voice that was hungry and emotionally needy and wanted the chocolate bar. And at the same time, could also honor the part of me that took this vow not to eat after 12 noon. That these were not really in opposition or mutually exclusive of one another, but that I could, we can increase our container, our capacity for holding even the opposites that exist in life, the duality. And by opening and broadening that container, we can sit with all of it, and it's very liberating to be able to do that. And I felt a sense of peace and liberation in that moment that I could get through what was for me in right then a very difficult experience.
That's pretty amazing that you were able to have that experience so profoundly after only about an hour.
Well, I had done meditation in the past, and I had a spiritual path. One of the other reasons I went to the monastery was to deepen my spiritual path and see if I could, not just with food, but also alter some other repetitive toxic patterns in my life. And so I had always, I had been very interested in Hinduism prior to that, and read a lot of the work of Krishnamurti and Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, and had done meditations, and so I think I was primed for it in a way, and I think that somehow.
Yeah, may I ask how old you were when you went to the monastery?
I was in my 40s.
Uh huh. Okay.
My mid 40s, and which I hope lets anybody know we're never too old to awaken to and to break these old patterns and to clear out that clutter.
Yeah, good.
You don't have to go in a monastery to do it. I mean, I was ripe for the experience, and it worked well for me. But I do like to make the point for people that our daily experiences give us the work to push against, to work with. And
do they ever?
They really do.
Yeah. And how long were you in the monastery?
You know, I was in there for just a few months, and actually I had gone in there knowing it would just be for a period of time, but I think because I had the right teachers, and I was really ripe for the experience, I was kind of like already like an apple ready to fall off the tree.
Uh-huh. And so, why did you leave? I mean, how did you know that it was time?
Well,
and I'm surprised to hear that, because the image that I have, and probably many people have, is that, oh, when you go into the monastery, it might be for the rest of your life.
You know, it's interesting, actually. Every different cultures have different monastic traditions related to how long people will be in the monastery. And even while the monks that were in there with me, they had joined the monastery in Burma around the age of 11 or 12. And in that culture, it's very acceptable to join at a young age. And not every monk stays, but they did stay. And in that particular tradition, it's almost like you do the ordination, and you have a vow to stay there today. So it's a very present moment kind of a vow. And the next day, I'll be here today. And there's no lifetime vow that you take, as opposed to, for example, in the Benedictine tradition, monks will often join the monastery for a trial period, and I'm not exactly sure how many years that is, but there's a trial period to see how that person, how they accept the experience, and then whether the other brothers find that this person fits in the community. And then after a period of years, they would then decide whether or not to take a lifetime vow. So it's actually very different in different communities. In fact, in the some of the Southeast Asian countries where Theravadaism is practiced, which is Laos, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Burma, and Thailand, in those countries, it's not uncommon for men, actually, when they get older, to decide that they've fulfilled the obligations and responsibilities to their family, and that they will end their later years of life and their life in the monastery. It's something we can't really conceive of here.
Yeah. Now you're also trained as a counselor, right?
That's correct. And that really was an outgrowth of being in the monastery, because after I came out of the monastery, it changed my life. And I had many friends who said I was a different person. I think I changed dramatically in how I viewed myself and how I viewed the world and others. And I think I had a much more compassionate perspective on things, and just learned that really to more and more disidentify with that, the ego, and to learn how to, what I call, step off the emotional elevator, you know, things that are pushing our buttons and making us go up and down and moving our moods all around. And I was working with, when I came out, I wrote a book called Art of the Inner Meal. Art of the Inner Meal is one of the first, really a pioneering book in the mindful eating field. And I started doing workshops for people with who wanted to make eating a spiritual path and really look at it in that way, which is a very beautiful way, by the way, to connect with food and to change our relationship to food and eating and even body image. And while I was doing that, I was having people come up to me at the end of the workshops who were saying, you know, in kind of a hushed tone, you know, I have this eating disorder issue, or I have this anorexia problem or this bulimia problem. And so I went back to school, went back to graduate school to see how I could work with people also on a therapeutic level and not just the spiritual part of food. And then worked with at an intensive outpatient eating disorder clinic at a hospital for several years here in the Portland.
Right.
Here in the Portland area.
Yeah, and now, I know I'm jumping you around back and forth a lot here. I hope you don't mind.
No, it's okay.
So you're mentioning the eating work that you did after that book. Kind of takes me back to the beginning of the conversation where you went into the monastery to kind of wrestle with your eating demon. And so I kind of want to know how that turned out.
Well, it was kind of an amazing journey for me. I didn't eat the chocolate bar. I should tell you.
You didn't take the chocolate out and then somehow puff up the package so it would look like it hadn't been touched.
fact,
you see where my mind goes.
In fact, the first thought I had when I saw the chocolate bar, I'll never forget it, was somebody set me up. I thought.
Yeah.
They knew I was going to sit there, and they put the chocolate bar there, and that's how mine was work. My mind was working, I guess. But what I learned was people would just donate things to the monks, and somebody probably donated this chocolate bar, and they put it in that room, and probably later gave it away to somebody. So, it turned out that working with food and mindful eating turned out to be an area that I've done a lot of work in, and I ended up working at that eating disorder clinic and becoming one of the board members of a new organization. We just had our 10-year anniversary called the Center for Mindful Eating.
Great.
And yeah, the Center for Mindful Eating has been doing great work. I was the vice president for a period of time also. But we provide patient handouts we do teleconferences for people working in the eating disorder field, for professionals. We also do have information for anybody, for the layperson who wants to find out more about mindful eating and what is that, and we have that on our website as well. We also have some talks that are available for anybody. So if somebody's interested in learning what is it like to eat mindfully, that can be a wonderful mindfulness practice. I call it the really the master's level practice in mindfulness.
Well, I'm still wondering, did you lose weight?
Well, you know,
that's irrelevant. I don't know, but that seems relevant.
Yeah, I never really had a weight problem.
It wasn't a weight problem. What was it if it wasn't a weight problem?
Well, it was an emotional comfort problem. It was how I worked with my emotions. It was how I tried to soothe myself, and it just wasn't the most healthy way of doing that. And I think it bled over to other areas too. What I learned is that I could become more conscious of my eating patterns and my habits and my hunger, as I could become more conscious of all the other clutter in my life. I think we have clutter in one area of our lives. We probably have it in other areas. So I will say, I mean, I did create a mindful eating program, 12 weeks to mindful eating, that for people who experience binge eating or just feel out of control with food.
Sure.
And that's what I felt, out of control with food, that you could moderate that a lot better.
Okay, now I want to go back to the process of your leaving, because it's, you know, you're also have training as a therapist, and there's that whole issue of termination, which you know, has a lot of sort of charged issues around it. And so I'm wondering, were there parallels for you in your decision to leave the monastery? Did you have conversations with the spiritual master?
I appreciate that you asked me that. Nobody's ever asked me that, and I never actually thought of it in terms of, like, you know, as therapists, we think about terminating with clients and how we need a conversation around that. And I did have a conversation, more than one, with some of the different monks, and in particular with one monk who I became almost like a spiritual brother to, and he was a very learned monk. There's actually a ceremony for turning back the robes, for handing them back.
Uh-huh.
So part of that ceremony was doing that. But also, I continued to receive training from that particular monk. So I would continue to go to the monastery, and we would he would teach me different practices. So I continued to train, and then continued to go to other work in the area of Dzogchen meditation, and continue to expand my knowledge of other kinds of forms of meditation. So I always felt that even though I left the monastery, I carried it with me in my heart, and I still do.
Yeah, and say a little bit about the conversations that you alluded to around leaving.
Yeah, well, I was actually given some vows to take when I left the monastery. And these were vows such as not to do harm to others, not to sexually, harm others due to your sexuality. There's certain precepts to be truthful and so on. And so I was given some of these vows or precepts that as a monk, of course, you take, but as a layperson, you don't take as many of those. I mean, I think as a monk, we had over 250 different vows that we would take and try to adhere to as a monk.
Wow.
So there were still some that I did when I backed out of a monastery. And so it was a process of, and like I say, I would go in once a week afterwards and was kept doing training, even though I left
the
monastery, and did some wonderful work with mantras and some of what are known as the mystical mantras of Buddhism, and some wonderful way, and a loving kindness practice I continue to work on. And so there were some wonderful things that I felt really contributed, that so I didn't feel like I was really missing on the experience as much. And the other part of it is that I really felt that the work I wanted to do was out here in the world.
Yes.
Through my writing and through teaching, and I travel extensively around the United States and also internationally now, actually doing workshops. Many of them are for business people, but a lot of them are for people in the therapy field, teaching mindfulness interventions for counselors, psychologists, nurse practitioners, and so on. helping them use these tools for anxiety, depression, stress, pain, and so on. And basically many of the things that are really central to this Clearing Emotional Clutter book. And I think it's exciting to see that these kind of practices are in the therapy field now. It's something that when I was in the monastery, when I went from the monastery and not too much later went back to grad school, I was a little concerned about how these kinds of practices, whether or not they'd be accepted or whether I could continue to, because I had seen the benefit of them, seen how they had, how healing they were in a lot of different ways. And what's exciting is that psychotherapy has really embraced a lot of that, and there are a lot of programs using mindfulness, and that has been evidence-based, which is wonderful.
Yeah, it certainly has taken fire, I must say. There are so many books, and I've done quite a few interviews around that topic. And why do you think that is? Why do you think it's taken fire so much in, I guess, in this country, but even well beyond?
Well, and it's funny. I mean, I think if you look back in the therapy field, I think mindfulness was there in different forms. Existentialism and, dealing with angst and anxiety was a part of therapy. And maybe this is maybe a little bit of new wine old wine in a new bottle, but I think it's informed from an ancient practice, which is really looked at the science of the mind, which is what the Buddha did. And so I think it's maybe informed in a little different way. And I think the power of it is that it allows people to be to feel that you're not being judged.
Yes, yes, very important,
and
I think.
Yeah, and one of the tools of it that I see and I talk about is just developing compassionate presence. The recognition that everybody has suffered. I mean, somebody cuts you off on the freeway and you get angry, upset, why'd they do that? But then you start to realize, wait, this person, their suffering maybe is overflowing. And, you could take the bigger picture and start to understand there isn't a person alive, I don't think, there isn't anybody that can avoid aging or having loss in their life and grieving and suffering. So, there's the full palette of colors that life has, and we experience the richness of the joy, but we also experience the sadness, and we share that. It's our human, I could almost see it as our human mutual experience. And so we can look at somebody and understand that even that difficult person in our life has suffered in some way.
Yeah,
they're not just trying. Their job in life isn't to make our life miserable.
Right.
Right. It might be like that, but if we could really understand it, we could start to understand the suffering they've had. And that could help us shift into a greater place of compassion and acceptance. And so I think that this non-judging acceptance, and then, of course, self-acceptance is so powerful that we can stop blaming ourselves. We're in a very, I don't know how you feel about this, but I think we're in a very critical culture where the weaknesses seem to be always at the forefront, and we can take that inside and have our own committee of internal voices pointing out all our faults all the time. And,
sure. I think that's very common. Coming back to your book, and of course everything you're saying is an outgrowth of what's in your book, the subtitle of your book is Mindfulness Practices for Letting Go of What's Blocking Your Fulfillment and Transformation. And I notice you use the terms fulfillment and transformation rather than enlightenment. And for a long time, there was a lot of interest in enlightenment and trying to become enlightened. What's the difference?
Well, I think you could define enlightenment just as not being encumbered or entangled. Whenever you're really able to experience this moment and participate fully in this moment and savor it, even the littlest things of life, I think that's a form of freedom and liberation. But I think we can get stuck and hung up on this idea of enlightenment and that it's some endpoint, something we have to, get to. instead of just recognizing that we could, understand some of the ways that we may not be fully participating in life. I have an acronym in the book called Pair Up that describes kind of what, as I've been teaching mindfulness over the years and I've deepened my understanding of it, it's altered how I view it. And so, I think it's important to try to understand that just, not to try to do too much. It's a kind of that spiritual materialism. I get stuck on grabbing too tightly on getting this enlightenment. And really, it's about how can we have this greater clarity in this moment? How can we be free from emotional negativity? How could we be more harmonious and relate better to everybody who's around us?
Yeah. Are you saying that there's more focus now on the process rather than the end point?
Absolutely.
It's an endless practice in a way, and not a point of final arriving.
Yeah, it's a practice of a greater awakened awareness of what's happening right now.
Yes,
and being more intentional and purposeful about what we're doing, so that we don't harm others unnecessarily or harm ourselves unnecessarily.
Yeah, and I think along the way there are sort of many experiences, M-I-N-I, many experiences.
Yeah.
And you described one at the beginning of our discussion here when you were able to detach from the Cadbury bar, and for a short period there you were just kind of suspended with all of that mental activity that had been going on. There was a space there, if I understand right, where you were just there.
And I think that if we could tap more into that space and recognize that space, a kind of open, spacious awareness of the mind that exists between all the thoughts. If I take a bucket of paint and I throw it up into the air, take a bucket of red paint, it doesn't paint the air red.
I love that example. You use that example in the book, and I'd never heard it before, and I thought, boy, that's just a wonderful metaphor.
Yeah. In the same way, our thoughts aren't defining us, and they're temporary, fleeting experiences that they don't really color the basic spaciousness of mind. And so, I have some different meditations for helping people start to notice that bigger sense of the mind that exists. It's just empty of all these thoughts and of all this phenomena. These changes going on moment by moment.
Yeah, you gave a very nice description of one of those moments of spaciousness, which I think might also be called kind of a Satori experience, where you were looking at a lemon. I don't know if you can remember that well enough to tell that here.
Right.
But that seemed like a real kind of breakthrough moment.
Yeah, that was a little story that was told where I interviewed someone by the name of Paul Harrison, who's a Zen practitioner, and he had that experience with the lemon tree, and it said that he completely lost awareness of himself when he was looking at these lemons. He began staring at one of these lemons, and he found that there was a total shift in his perception in that moment, and it was just an empty awareness that was alive, and that the I, as I call, I like to think of it as the I, me, the mind, just kind of disappeared into the background, and the larger him appeared. It was able to just expansive elements, sense of the mind was able to be present, and I think we all experience it. If you think about the first time you saw the Grand Canyon, or really, when you go, you look at a sunset, or and you see nature in some beautiful way, and the observer, and what you're observing almost become one. It's as if they merge, and the sense of self gets out of the way.
Yeah, maybe we should, you know, we've gone charging on, but maybe we should take a moment to have you define emotional clutter and why that's something that we should be concerned about.
Okay. Emotional clutter can come from a lot of different sources. It can come from past conditioned ways of thinking. It can come from reactivity. It can come from seeing the evening news and getting fearful.
Oh, yeah.
We're worried about things. And then that worry, and of course, there's a part of the brain that is lighting up like a Christmas tree when we experience anything that could be threatening or dangerous. And that fills our mind. That really, that's like clutter. It just blocks us from seeing anything else. It becomes a dominant viewpoint. Or times when we're worried about the future. Or maybe just stuck on the past. I worked with clients who had a story that was repeating over and over in their heads. I'll never forget the woman who I one time came to see me, and she had this story about, you know, my mother, she abused me, she mistreated me, and even though this was our first initial meeting, she kept returning that story over and over. And I finally asked her, I said, "I, you know, it's obvious that's a very important story to you. And I'm curious, have you ever counted the number of times you've told yourself that story in the course of a day?" And she paused and looked at me, and she said, "You know, it's funny you asked me that. I have tried to count how many times I tell that story, but I always lose track." And then she said, "I know, but what I notice when I don't tell that story, I'm a lot happier." So getting stuck in a rut in an old story is another form of clutter. I think anything that makes us feel overwhelmed, stresses that occur throughout our day, can create clutter in the moment. You know, we have family clutter. We have those maybe difficult persons in our life or old patterns, maybe unhappy patterns of relating that keep repeating in our lifetimes. And so our addictions, I mean, these are all forms of clutter. So it can take many, many different forms. And yet it, what they all have in common is that they dysregulate us. They don't allow us to be to have clarity, to have a sense of peace, a sense of calm. And they don't connect us with our deeper intention and our purpose. And so we're kind of, you know, it's almost like, imagine just going through a shredder and how it takes a piece of paper and just, you know, breaks them into little pieces. And that's kind of what it feels like, maybe, is we don't feel whole and we don't feel at ease and able to really savor life.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I like about your book is that there are frequent references to some of the science around all of this. And one of the things that you say is that emotional clutter actually affects us at the cellular level. What's that based on? Maybe say a little bit about that.
There's this is really amazing what we're learning of how our daily experiences actually seep into our cells, and again, they change hundreds of biological processes. So, for example, a lot of different ways that could manifest. So there have been studies where people have been shown if they go to bed lonely or sad, that when you wake up in the morning, you'll have a high, what's known as a cortisol awakening response. So there's a heavier load of cortisol in the body. Cortisol is a kind of a biological signature that you're not having a great day. And if there is too much cortisol, if it stays in the body 2 or 3 days, it becomes kind of becomes like the chronic stress state. Cortisol actually puts the brakes on your immune system, so it will depress your T cell count. It will actually kill natural NK cells. Those are called natural killer cells, and they fight viruses and even some kinds of tumors. So here we are, that our daily experiences are actually making it more difficult for us to stay healthy, and it really damages our immune system. It also can cortisol can kill cells in the learning center of the brain, the hippocampus, it's called, the new learning part of the brain, so it makes it harder for us to learn. There's also this idea of epigenetics that I could talk about for a moment, which is the idea. Yeah, and epigenetics is fascinating. one of the persons who's doing new work in this field is Herbert Benson, and I'm sure you've heard of him.
Yes.
And Herbert Benson identified the relaxation response back in the late 60s. He was a cardiologist working at Harvard. And when he first started doing this work, believe it or not, Harvard almost fired him from his job. And now there's a Herbert Benson Medical Center, and they gave him an honorary degree. But his initial work was about how we could turn on the relaxation response in the body, that it really, there's a way through breathing to actually bring us into this more relaxed, calm state.
You're reminding me that he was very interested in or impacted by transcendental meditation.
And, that's right.
And took a step towards stripping away the spiritual tradition, dogma, whatever, and just got people meditating right. on one, the word one.
He just made it more secular.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, and it was interesting that what his new work is fascinating is he's continued to work with the relaxation response, and now he's begun to understand that how we breathe, how we are aware in the moment, and he makes the point it doesn't have to be breathing, it could be a prayer practice, it could be a mindful movement practice, a Tai Chi, it could be yoga, that any of these, if you do these for just a few minutes a day, it actually turns on a set of genes in the body related to the to our aging free radicals and the immune system. So a set of 2,200 different genes are turned on or off depending on how we pay attention in this moment and how we regulate ourselves. So you can think of the genome as the kind of the computer that's in our body, and but the epigenome, the word epa means above the gene. The epigenome is like the software that tells our computer what to do. And so how we pay attention in the moment, how we breathe, and how we do some of these relaxation practices actually is like the software that turns on our genes, on and off. And this happens moment by moment, that our genes are actually expressing by how we're interacting with the environment. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that really is amazing. And you also point out that the circumstances of modern life leads to lots of emotional clutter, maybe more so than back in the day when Buddha and others were developing this approach. And you had a passage on page 5 that I'd like to read because I thought it was such a good example. You write, "It's not just the big life transitions, even making a small decision, such as where and how to buy a book, can require many choices, internet or retail store, independent bookstore or chain, price or convenience, digital book or printed book, standard shipping, two-day shipping or overnight, cash, PayPal, credit card or debit card." And, you know, that was just sort of honing in on one of the zillion things that we're dealing with in today's world.
Oh my
I think
God.
It's more challenging to be mindful now, maybe, than it was a long time ago.
I think it is. I think we are probably more inundated with sources, with different messages and advertising than ever before in history. And then, again, we also have to make many, many more choices. Food psychologists say we make an average number of more than 200 different choices just related to food, just on that. How about many other choices we have to make? And every time we start making these choices, it actually depletes the brain of mental energy. And so it's important for us to think about how we can restore some of that depleted energy. And that's why I talk about spending some time to look at nature. There's a whole field of study, actually, Dr. Dave, and I don't know if you know of attention restoration theory, but it was developed in the late 70s by a guy named Stephen Kaplan. He was a psychologist at the University of Michigan, and he noticed something very interesting. He noticed that during the high levels of study, midterms and finals, that students would flock outside, and you know, he got curious because they could have gone anywhere. Why were they going outside? And so he and work in that field has now shown that looking at nature can actually restore depleted mental energy and help us recover.
Yeah, I fully believe that to be the case. Now, earlier you mentioned something that you refer to as the emotional elevator. Maybe you can take us through that a little bit.
Oh, sure. I think of the emotional elevator as when things go your way, your emotions go up. You get that job at the house, you have a happy thought, right? Or somebody compliments you and the elevator goes up.
Yeah.
These are things that are, you know, kind of like pushing our buttons. But what about the elevator going down? What moves your elevator down? And in fact, maybe a friend doesn't text you back right away, or you don't get that promotion that you wanted, or something, you have a job review and maybe it didn't go as well as you thought. And so now you go down. And so we can start chasing those ups and downs, start trying to avoid the downs and start chasing the up elevator. And it might seem exhilarating for a while, but it's really exhausting actually. And so I think it's important to learn how to get off that elevator and to start to not have to, to kind of find a place of equanimity, knowing that there are going to be ups and downs all the time. And we don't have to try to grab on or identify only with the positives in life. There are, there's going to be a full range of experiences in life. But so I actually have a meditation for trying to help people get off the off that elevator.
And in the book, I think the message comes through that you're not trying to get people to deny the up experiences and the down experiences in their life as much as to get some distance from it.
So that's correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that if we can just notice that critical thought, for example, just observe that in a very neutral way, say, oh, okay, that's part of my experience here, right, without necessarily grabbing on or defining ourselves by it, or experiencing sadness, that we're going to experience there's nothing innately wrong with feeling sadness. If we're dwelling on sadness, though, well, we may need to broaden out our awareness and find some more joy, right? Well, how can we find the balance? And so I'm not saying that need to avoid or discard challenging or difficult negative experiences. I mean, that's part of life as well.
Yeah, and I go back to that example that you used earlier about being pulled out of a scary movie, that to kind of get that bit of remove when the light is turned on and to realize, hey, this is just a movie I'm watching here.
Right, and I think that could be a very powerful experience for people when they get that distance. How can we become more friends with our mind? How can we get off? I almost think of it as, you have some anxious thoughts, and I think of it as stepping on a train. You know, if you step on a train of anxious, you can think of that as a train of thoughts, but if I got on a train of anxious thoughts, I often ask clients, well, if I stay on that train, where does it take me? And I've had to say things like, Anxietyville or Anxious Land, right, or Dwellsville, if I'm dwelling on thoughts.
Yeah.
So we're learning how to just step off the train and get back onto the platform, just noticing, okay, these thoughts exist, there they are, and, but I don't necessarily have to hold too tightly onto them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's the holding on too tightly and that actually creates anxiety attacks, and a lot of the suffering that we endure in life comes from also comes from our just not wanting to be where we're at, wanting to resist this moment. And there are challenges in life, and so if we resist and think things are always going to be better elsewhere, we're never going to be in a place of acceptance and openness.
Yeah. Now, there's another term you use in the book, kind of grabbing hold of the of the moment and the interest in social media, social networking, and you have this term inner Facebooking. So tell us, what do you mean by inner Facebooking? Well, outer Facebooking is consuming enough.
Well, yeah. And so think about how outer Facebooking affects you. You know, here people are putting up posts, talking about their lives and everything, and that can, of course, affect us. And at the same time, there's a second kind of Facebook, and this is the inner posts of our thoughts and belief systems that we put up all the time. And this shapes our world, shapes our experience. And if your inner Facebooking posts that you're putting up in your mind are unhappy, unflattering, no wonder that you don't feel well. Maybe you feel depressed or bad. And so I have a whole chapter in the book about noticing your inner Facebook posts so that you can become more aware. I also call it taking an inner selfie, a mental inner selfie, right? That you can actually look at your thoughts and start to notice what they are. And then think about, how could I put up a more accurate thought? I mean, your inner selfies may not be very accurate.
What would an example of that be?
Well, an example of that would be, something that I've experienced. I might be doing a workshop and it seems like everything's going too well and they love it. And I might, think, I'm ready for Oprah now.
Yeah, right. I am so cool. Yeah.
They love it. It's great, right? Or maybe somebody comes up after the workshop and says, I didn't really like that exercise you had us do, or I didn't understand what you were talking about. And then I'm like, I might have an inner Facebook post that says, oh, boy, they hated me, and I should just, my speaking career is goner. It's a toast, right?
Yeah.
So, we can put up these posts all the time, and I think we are. Our minds can be populated with it, and that's another kind of clutter that causes suffering to us, right?
Yeah,
and
definitely.
So it's important to know, there's a more accurate way of looking at it. I could look at that information or that comment, that feedback, and say, maybe I could improve this. So I could also look at the things that are working, and so I could take a more balanced perspective with things and also try to be encouraging of myself, saying, I can always improve, I can get better, I can, I also like to think in some way that you might find this kind of funny, but I think 7 is the new 10. We can, we can judge ourselves very harshly. I remember one time I did a presentation. It was my first national conference presentation, and I was there, and I met another presenter. It was his first time doing a presentation nationally, and we both came out of our presentations at the same time and met up and started talking, and neither of us felt we did a really good job. I changed many things before I did the presentation, and I was trying to make it perfect, right?
Yeah.
And as a result, I was more worried about that than just really being present with the presentation. And we both started talking about how our presentations were not our best. And then he said something that I really loved. He said, we both rated our presentations like a 7 out of 10. And then he said, 7 is really a 10.
The new 10.
It's the new 10. And then he said, if you really think about it, and his specialty was positive psychology and the happiness field, he said, if you really look at it, if you're at a 7, the effort you would take to make something a 10 would be, it might be even counterproductive for you to try to do that. And you could appreciate that you did, but that a 7 was good enough.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned positive psychology, because clearly that's something that you have embraced, and you've got quite a book, lot of discussion running through the book on finding your strengths, which is one of the key outgrowths of Seligman's work and the whole positive psychology movement.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I find that very helpful area to have people look at and start to identify their strengths. And even, for example, to think of one of your strengths, and this was actually shown to decrease depression significantly, to find one of your strengths and put it into action one time a day for a week. And see how it makes you feel, and notice how it does affect you, how does it affect those you come into contact with, and use that strength with.
What would be an example of that if one of our listeners wanted to try that out for a week?
Well, let's say you had, let's say your strength was hospitality. So you like to be hospitable and welcome people. And so maybe one day you would go to your office and you might ask somebody, hey, can I'm going over to the coffee machine. Can I grab you a cup of coffee? Right? Or maybe you do something, you hold a door open for somebody. Right? You smile at somebody. You do one little thing a day for the entire week that focuses on that particular strength that you have. And so there are over 100 different strengths that have been identified in all the different areas. And in fact, there's a real nice website, actually, if somebody wants to go check out strengths. It's called, and again, this is an offshoot of the Seligman work. It's viacharacter.org, viacharacter.org. And they have a strengths assessment you can take to look at your 24 top strengths. Well, it's kind of a fun thing to do, but I think
it
has...
Via V-I-A character?
Yeah, V-I-A character.org. Okay. And it doesn't cost anything to do that, to take that strengths test. But I feel that strengths are a wonderful way of counterbalancing all the negative clutter that we may have about ourselves. And this is not a form of bragging. I like to make the point in my book that... this is not an exercise in bolstering your ego or saying, oh, look how great I am. But it's trying to be accurate, trying to look at, you know, how I'm effective in my life and how I can impact others in a positive way. And so not to, you know, why would we not want to do that? I mean, it could really have beneficial effects for ourselves and others. So I think it's a really nice way to start thinking about things that we often don't even pay attention to.
Yeah, for some reason we seem to focus more on our weaknesses than on our strengths, and more on the negative than on the positive. As somebody who did university teaching for a long time, it was always striking to me how one person might have a complaint about the class, and that would loom so large. And I would have to remind myself over and over again, you know, that I would catch myself focusing on that negative thing where, you know, maybe one person out of 30, I could focus on the 27 or 25 people who are very pleased, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, and it's kind of a mind training, isn't it? It's kind of an awareness of you're noticing where your mind is going. And that you can rewire the brain. This is actually what's happening in the brain. You're creating new patterns of thinking and using your attention in a new way. You're rewiring your brain up. And that changes how you think in the future.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it doesn't really take as much time as you might think to rewire the brain. In fact... Many of these studies that are done, they look at the brain and they'll do some MRI imaging, look at functional activity in the different parts of the brain after 8 weeks or 12 weeks, but it's really incremental, just a few minutes a day. You know, if you're going to the gym, you might not notice the change day to day, but after a couple of months, you do. It's the same thing here in the brain, that there's a subtle change in some of the connectivity that starts to take place in the brain. And to think that where I that the thoughts I have and where I place my attention can change the physical structure of the brain is a very empowering idea.
And that takes me back to sort of where we began, which was that spiritual teacher that you were so impressed with. I've forgotten his name. Refresh.
Yeah, the Venerable Uthilananda.
Yes, okay. Yeah. And so presumably he had... spent years and years and years of, as you say, rewiring his brain to where your experience of him very quickly felt transformational, that there was this quality of presence and compassion, you said.
Mm-hmm. And he, yeah, and I could really feel it. It was very palpable. And to think that, it's beautiful to think that this is the potential that is within all of us, to have this kind of open-heartedness and this kindness and willingness to want to be there for others.
Yeah.
That that we can actually attain that state of being. That it's not phony, it's not imaginary, it's, but it is something very real.
You know, I'm intrigued by some of your other titles. I saw a list of them in the front of this book, and one that caught my interest was 1 minute mindfulness. We Americans are so we're looking for the quick fix. So how do you talk about 1 minute mindfulness and still avoid that sort of trap?
Yeah, and the idea behind 1 minute mindfulness, and you know, it's really interesting. It's I think it's been a very popular book, and I think because of the fact that people think, oh, I could just do this for 1 minute.
Yeah.
But the truth is that we can only be mindful right here anyway. And that was the idea behind that book, that we could be present in these little 1 minute pieces throughout our day, that we could knit together a mindfulness practice through the different ways of being present throughout our day and develop a more complete way of being present.
Yes.
So there's nothing tricky about it. There's nothing... it's mindfulness, but it's just mindfulness in the small ways that maybe you never thought of. Like, just how do you wake up in the morning? How do you sense your body? How do you, what is it like when you taste the first bite of food in the morning? What's the taste in your mouth when you wake up? What's it like when you're under the shower in the morning? And really just having people start to savor and experience those moments. And in emotional clearing, emotional clutter, I call it fidelity to the moment, or faithfulness to this moment. So we could be faithful right now. I want you, wherever anybody is listening to this, if you're sitting down, for example, spend a moment just being 100% committed to the experience of sitting, right? Feeling your feet on the floor, noticing your body in the chair, your posture, right? Feeling the pressure of your chair on the body and so forth. Or if you're walking, just devoting yourself to the experience of walking 100%. So we can have fidelity to every little thing that we do throughout the day. And that really is what 1 minute mindfulness is about.
And that's the trick. Being mindful enough to remember to be mindful.
and I also, by the way, I call it remindfulness, because we will forget, and that's okay.
Yeah, that's the non-judgment part is really so important, too. Well, you know, we've come to the place where probably makes sense to wind down. There's a lot more in your book or books that we could discuss, but I wonder, is there any sort of last word that you'd like to add?
Well, I'd like to say that I think mindfulness is a wonderful way to start to feel more fulfilled with life and more connected to others. And I'd like to invite your listeners to come to my website at mindfulpractices.com. That's MINDFUL practices.com. And I have a mindful living newsletter there. So you can sign up for that. I have new research in the mindfulness field. And I have a reflection that comes out once a month. So there's a reflection that you can use on a daily basis just to clear away some of that clutter and get more centered and find some more, hopefully more harmony and ease in life. I think we're here not to be steeped in anxiety and fear and worry, but to really to find joy and peace.
Okay, well, that's an excellent wrap-up, and I know some of my listeners will really look into your site and grab hold of some of these ideas. So, Donald Altman, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, Dr. Dave, thank you for the opportunity to have this really enjoyable talk with you and explore some of these ideas. Thanks again.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Donald Altman, M.A. There are lots of books out there now on mindfulness. I think the strong point of Altman's book is that it takes a very down-to-earth, practical approach that anyone can relate to. He avoids the technical details of Buddhist theory and vocabulary. Instead, he uses everyday terms and concepts such as emotional clutter, fulfillment, emotional elevator, inner Facebooking, cultivating a beautiful garden of thought, compassionate communication, friendship seeds, daily snapshots of joy, and so on. He's really writing for the mainstream. Also, I think there's a nice balance of self-disclosure, case examples, references to recent scientific studies, and mindfulness exercises. Speaking of references to recent science, I was delighted to see him refer to a large study by last week's guest, Professor Peter Kinderman of the University of Liverpool. It always feels very confirming to me to discover that I do indeed have my finger on the pulse of the movers and shakers. If not for yourself, Altman's book would make an excellent gift for someone you know who would value an introduction to mindfulness. You can find an ad for Donald Altman's latest book, Clearing Emotional Clutter, in the left-hand sidebar on our site. Clicking it will take you directly to his publisher's site.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Pete from Andalusia. Just ringing to say that my partner Sue and I have been listening and learning from your podcast for a year or so now. Feel increasingly guilty that you were working your socks off for us, giving while we were just taking. Now we can continue benefiting from your efforts with an easy conscience. Well worth a donation. Well, that's all. May I just say, may your microphone never go dry, Dave. We'll continue listening. Ciao.
Thank you, Pete, living the good life there in Andalusia and helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio and encouraging others to follow suit. In fact, we do have one new donor since the last episode. My sincere thanks goes out to Helena Burton. Let me remind you that you can use the Amazon.com search widget in our right-hand sidebar to purchase more than just books. It's not for nothing that Amazon's been called the everything store. If you'll remember to go to our site and use that widget for all your Amazon purchases, it will really help us. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. We do in our family. If you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code and Shrink Wrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. And it all adds up, so it's another way that you can help to support us. And in the left-hand sidebar, you can click on special deals from Amazon. For example, you can save up to 90% on textbooks, and there's a little box that has a different special from Amazon that changes every day. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, as I've said many times, my recommendation today fits quite well with today's discussion of clearing emotional clutter. It's the currently very popular book on tidying up the external clutter in your home, which in turn can certainly help to reduce emotional clutter, in my opinion. I'm referring to The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up by Marie Kondo and read by Emily Wu Zeller. Let me play you a little sample.
When you tidy your space completely, you transform the scenery. The change is so profound that you feel as if you are living in a totally different world. This deeply affects your mind and inspires a strong aversion to reverting to your previously cluttered state. The key is to make the change so sudden that you experience a complete change of heart. The same impact can never be achieved if the process is gradual. To achieve a sudden change like this, you need to use the most efficient method of tidying. Otherwise, before you know it, the day will be gone and you will have made no headway. The more time it takes, the more tired you feel, and the more likely you are to give up when you're only halfway through. When things pile up again, you will be caught in a downward spiral. From my experience with private individual lessons, quickly means about half a year. That may seem like a long time, but it is only 6 months out of your entire life. Once the process is complete and you've experienced what it's like to be perfectly tidy, you will have been freed forever from the mistaken assumption that you're no good at tidying. For the best results, I ask that you adhere faithfully to the following rule: tidy in the right order. As we've seen, there are only two tasks involved: discarding and deciding where to keep things. Just two, but discarding must come first. Be sure to completely finish the first task before starting the next. Do not even think of putting your things away until you have finished the process of discarding. Failure to follow this order is one reason many people never make permanent progress. In the middle of discarding, they start thinking about where to put things. As soon as they think, "I wonder if it will fit in this drawer," the work of discarding comes to a halt. You can think about where to put things when you've finished getting rid of everything you don't need. To summarize, the secret of success is to tidy in one shot, as quickly and completely as possible, and to start by discarding.
And it goes on from there. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not your taste, they now have more than 225,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Dr. James Greenblatt, a psychiatrist, author, and integrative medicine pioneer. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. James Greenblatt. And it just so happens Dr. Greenblatt will be my guest again on the next episode. I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail using our app or on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Donald Altman, for sharing his insights on clearing our emotional clutter. As you heard earlier, psychiatrist James Greenblatt, MD, will be my next guest. You may recall I spoke to him previously on episode number 406 on listening to your gut. Your real gut, that is. You know, the one just below the middle of your body. Well, he's got a newly released second edition titled Breakthrough Depression Solution: Mastering Your Mood with Nutrition, Diet, and Supplementation. So if you've got the guts, join us next time. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.